2012, January 5th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 3, Imagining Other Worlds. Well, let's really get in. Yesterday's lecture was very much on the line of, okay, let's do the boring numbers stuff and get it out of the way. Today I want to get into the meat of the course. This course is about trying to understand the idea of life in the universe. But sometimes in order for a question that we really want the answer to make sense, the question itself has to make sense to ask. Now, we live in an age when we have a very broad range of ideas and possibilities opened up to us. But that's not always been the case. And sometimes a question doesn't make any sense to ask, so nobody asks it, sometimes for a very long time. So today what I want to look at is to explore the cultural underpinnings of our ideas about other worlds. In particular, always a little technical glitch. What we want to do in this lecture is really start out the class by reviewing sort of the cultural underpinnings of this idea of the question of other worlds and the possibility of lives on other worlds. And part of this is going to be an historical approach. It turns out that our imaginings about other worlds and life on them is, in fact, probably as old as our study of astronomy. We have musings about the possibility of other worlds that goes back almost 3,000 years. And yet the question is, at what point does those sort of musings and questions and imaginings become scientific? And that's part of what we're going to be building up to through the next couple of lectures. But in particular, what we're going to talk a little bit about in the middle part is how this idea actually languished for a long time. Plato and his student Aristotle actually ruled out the possibility of there being other worlds. And for nearly 18 centuries, the question really barely came up. It was only with the Copernican Revolution in the 16th century that by putting the Earth as another planet around the sun and literally making the universe infinite in extent, rekindled this idea and interest that there may be other worlds around other stars. And possibly with them, there may be life around those worlds. And we'll look at some of how these ideas, which were formally excluded by the Aristotelian view of the world that held through most of the Classical Age and the Middle Ages, really opened up in the 16th century and the way people began to respond and reflect those ideas in literature in particular. And then finally, I want to sort of bring up to speed sort of our modern notions of extraterrestrial life. We're saturated with representations of life on other worlds. The idea of life on other worlds is almost so second nature that people even come to believe it must be true. But let's look a little bit, for example, at some of those ideas and some of our imaginings of other worlds and ask, is there anything we can really draw from it? And the conclusion we're really going to come to is that actually we have many and wide and broad imaginings, but very few of them are very scientific in nature. They're actually not going to be very helpful to us in informing our inquiry into answering the question scientifically, is there life on other worlds? So let's step back a bit. Go to the earliest encounter of human beings with the nighttime sky. If you walk out to a very dark place, and I urge you in summertime, especially when the weather's decent, if you're out in a dark place, especially out in the wilderness areas, and you've got a clear night, please get outside and look at the sky. The sky is amazingly beautiful at night in a very dark place. You get the Milky Way above. If you're lucky enough to go and visit in the southern hemisphere, like Australia, South Africa, South America, the southern hemisphere sky is absolutely spectacular. One of the reasons I became an astronomer is because I found the night sky so beautiful growing up in the Mojave Desert of California. I was just absolutely fascinated by it. And this certainly my response and anyone's response to the beauty of the night sky and the points of light that fill the sky is probably no different than those of our ancient ancestors who first began to look up the sky and began to ask what was it they could see. We can see in the night sky over the course of the year with just the naked eye almost 6,000 stars. It kind of depends upon where you are on the planet and how good your vision is, but 6,000 or a few thousand stars is common. Now, from Columbus, we can see basically, a handful. But in a dark place, you can see thousands of stars. And it was clear that there was structure. People began to populate them with constellations. But this 6,000 is barely scratching the surface. It may seem like a lot. The starry night on a summer's night in the southern hemisphere or in the northern hemisphere, as breathtaking as it is barely scratching the surface. Of those few thousand stars we can see at any given time, there are only a fraction of the 200 billion that populate our own Milky Way galaxy. And estimates vary, but there could be tens of billions of other galaxies. Well, do the math. That's billions upon billions of stars. Okay, there's my obligatory Carl Sagan reference. But we've always wondered what they are. This means there's a lot of possible places to be thinking about as places where there may be other worlds. We've always wondered what the stars were. We've always been curious about them. Depictions of the sky are, in fact, very ancient. This picture right here, this is obviously a sketch and not a photograph and a layout of a domed ceiling of a tomb of an architect by the name of Senenmut. He was the favorite architect of Queen Hatshepsut, who was the famous woman pharaoh of the New Kingdom of Egypt in about 1500 BC. And he built for Queen Hatshepsut a beautiful mortuary tomb called Del El Bari, which is in Egypt today. And in Del El Bari, he was a favorite of Hatshepsut. He had his own tomb off to one side inside of that. And in one of the major vaulted chambers of this tomb, he had artists put on a very stylized depiction of the full nighttime sky as visible from the latitudes of Egypt in the 15th century. And although it's a very stylized appearance, we actually can see some very familiar constellations even in our own sky. And we'll take out this little section here and kind of turn it around. We can see it. There's Orion the Hunter wrangling with Taurus the Bull. And, of course, there are other various representations. But Orion and Taurus are ancient constellations. They're maybe 4,000 or 5,000 years old. Human beings have recognized these and seen these patterns of constellations in the sky. So we've always looked at the sky, and we've always imposed some kind of order upon it. And the sky changes very, very little over human timescales, even human timescales measured between the differences of great civilizations between ancient Babylonia to Egypt to the modern age. The sky that we see at night is substantially the same as the sky that is seen by our ancient ancestors. And it wasn't just in the West or in the Egyptian world that people began to populate the skies. For example, in Central America, we have very few survivals from the Spanish conquest of Central America, but in a few of the codices, we actually have depictions of the sky from the Aztec people, the Mexica, who lived in central Mexico. This is a very stylized representation of seven stars close together. This is the Pleiades, or the Seven Sisters, which the Aztec called Teotihuacanli, which in the Nahuatl language means the marketplace. It is a gathering place of stars. And so even the Aztec, the Maya, all of the ancient peoples of the New World, of what we call the New World, also organized the sky. They imposed mythologies, they imposed order upon it, they made measurements and tracked the motions of the stars. They too were curious enough to organize their information and wonder what the sky was like. This is a beautiful sky chart. It comes from the Dunhuang, which is a Chinese city in far eastern China, which is on the ancient Silk Road. It was one of the major stopping points for Silk Road caravans. And found buried out in the sands is this beautiful star map from the 7th century AD, from the Tang Dynasty. It stands out because it is the oldest surviving accurate map of the stars, in the sense that we can actually recognize constellations. For example, down here along the bottom third, you will recognize the constellation of the Big Dipper. Now, it's not perfectly accurate in terms of the placement of stars, but we can actually recognize a lot of these constellations. You can take a modern star mapping piece of software, put it for what you should see for the constellations that surround the North Celestial Pole in the 7th century AD from the latitude of Dunhuang, and you will actually be able to map most of these bright stars onto actual stars in the sky. This was an accurate map because people cared about making these maps accurately. So not only have the stars excited our curiosity, but they've begun to excite in many ways our art, our skill. We've developed mathematics to describe the motions of the heavens. We developed the highest arts of measurement to be able to make measurements on the sky. We use the motions of the heavens to build our calendars and keep time for us. So we've always had a very close connection with the heavens, and this has always been reflected in our wonderings about what is going on up there. But let's go beyond sort of these representations of the sky and ask the question, well, what if people start thinking about what the stars might be or the planets might be and speculations that went forward from them? The first real recorded ideas about other worlds, or by recorded ideas, I mean this is the first time we have a survival that comes down to us that I can put a date on. This doesn't mean people didn't think of it before, but those musings, if they were oral traditions or even written down, are lost to us, at least to the present. The ones we do have of the first survivals come to us, not surprisingly, from ancient Greece, from the Mediterranean world. And really the first musings about the nature of the heavens that began this idea that there may be other worlds comes to us through two philosophers. The father of philosophy was Thales of Miletus, who lived in the city of Miletus, which is out on the, in present day, is actually on the Aegean coast of Turkey, of Asia Minor, and his great student Anaximander, who both worked around the year 600 BC. So these are the first real philosophers. And what they came up with was the idea that the heavens were not simply bright lights pasted upon a hemispherical dome on the sky by the gods, but in fact were composed of physical objects, that the sun, the moon, and the stars, and the planets were physical things, and they could be described in terms of physical rules or natural rules for their behavior. Now, we know very little of the details of what both Thales and Anaximander said, but we know these ideas were highly influential, at least in the Eastern Mediterranean. Now, about a generation or more later, actually more than a generation later, Democritus, who was working in the Greek mainland, was one of the great philosophers sort of the pre-Platonic, pre-Aristotelian school. He was the man who, working with his teacher, Leucippus, came up with the idea that matter, stuff, was composed of atoms, these little uncuttable things, with mostly empty space in between them. And that the motions of these atoms and the behavior of these atoms was ruled by natural laws that could be expressed in an understandable form. This is a major advance. Now, we nowadays call one of the smallest units of matter the atom in honor of the Democritan idea. But what Democritus was thinking of as atoms really is very different than what modern atomic theory was about. But it was a beginning of thought, the idea that matter could be broken down into smaller and smaller bits, just like you could break a rock down from a big piece, eventually to powder so fine you couldn't even see it with the eye. And you could keep going forever. That infinite regress was a problem. So maybe the structure stopped. There was an indivisible point where you could stop dividing matter. But what makes Democritus important for us in a number of ways is this was a way of thinking about the world in which it was physical and understandable. And he also, Democritus, thought that this meant that the stars were physical, that the sun and moon were physical places, and that they were governed by those same natural laws as govern matter here on the earth. And this led him to the speculation that in fact the stars were other suns, and around them could be other worlds. There may be Earths out there which behave the same laws as Earth, but maybe there are Earths with no moon and sun, Earths with multiple suns or multiple moons. And he was able to begin to imagine other places ruled by physical law. This was a marvelous idea. But interestingly, it's an idea which was actually lost very shortly after the coming of Democritus. The philosopher Plato was said to have so hated the works of Democritus, he wished he could have burned all of them. So these ideas, while they emerged very early, didn't get traction in the Western world. And the reason is because of these two gentlemen, who are absolutely vital for the understanding of philosophy, but unfortunately set things back, namely Plato and his greatest student, Aristotle. They both lived during the 3rd century BC. They worked in or around Athens, of course. This was the major efflorescence of classical Greek society. Plato first came up with the idea that the earth was unique and unmoving at the center of a finite universe. And this was great later. These ideas were taken on by Aristotle and brought them further. They also had the idea that they structured the heavens with the earth at the bottom was a place of decay. Things were living but eventually died and decayed and bored away. If I pick something up and set it in motion upon the earth, it may rattle around and bounce off things, but eventually that motion stops. It decays and the object comes to rest. All objects ultimately come to rest upon the earth. Rain falls down and settles upon the earth. So the earth was a place of constant change. It was a place of chaos. Plato liked to think of there being a golden age, but he saw the chaos of Athenian society and the wars of the time as a sign that the earth was a place of death and change. But by contrast to that, the heavens, the motions of the stars, the motions of the sun and moon and the planets through the sky, were eternal, they were changeless, and they were perfect. The stars, the moon, sun, always rose in the east and set in the west every day, no matter what was going on upon the earth, whether there was changing weather or not. The planets, while their motions were complex, still were repeatable and predictable. It went on from time before to time thereafter. And so they made a division between the heavens and the earth, in which the earth and the places below the circle of the moon, which was the only changeable object in the heavens, it went through the cycle of phases through the month, was a place, the sublunar realm was the place of decay and death. It was the place where the rules of Earth abided. But in the heavens was a place of ceaseless, unchanging perfection. And so when you come to that conclusion, the stars cannot be other suns, there cannot be other worlds like the Earth, because that, if they had life on them, life must go through a cycle of birth, death, and decay. And you cannot have birth, death, and decay in the heavenly realm. So what Plato and Aristotle did by beautifully ordering the heavens in this way, and it was beautiful ideas if we now know they were basically wrong, was to actually close the door to deny the existence of other worlds and literally shut down the question of whether there is life on other worlds. The question no longer made sense because it was a nonsense question. Only life could live upon the Earth. This idea was to last, be a very strong idea in the Western world. It held on sway for nearly 18 centuries. But this isn't to say that people were bound to this idea, and there are other cultures beside this which actually flirted with ideas of life on other worlds. And I'm going to bring up two examples from non-Western cultures, or at least not more nominally non-Western cultures. The first of these is one of the oldest narrative stories that comes to us in Japanese, the 10th century Japanese story of the Takatori Monogatari, the tale of the bamboo cutter. Very simply, a poor bamboo cutter goes out one day, sees a piece of bamboo glowing strangely, slices through it, and finds inside a beautiful, tiny, little glowing girl. She's so beautiful, she brings them home because they're childless and they raise her as her own. And ever thereafter, whenever he cuts open a piece of bamboo, there's always a tiny gold nugget inside of them. And so he quickly grows wealthy. His daughter, who is terribly beautiful, grows into one of the most beautiful women of the kingdom. He becomes one of the most wealthy men of the kingdom of Japan. Suitors come and vie for her hand. But, of course, she turns all of them down with big tasks. It's a very classic mythological story. Finally, the emperor himself is smitten with her. And she refuses even the emperor because she knows she's not of this country. And every night she is always feels so heartbroken when she stares at the moon. And one day her real family, the inhabitants of the moon, come down and find her, bring her back to the moon in a celestial carriage. And of course, there's a nifty little little story after the end of that, where of course they want to leave. The parents are heartbroken. They want to leave a message. Even the emperor wants to leave a message to this beautiful woman. So they go to climb to the highest mountain possible to burn this message and hope it meets her. And that mountain thereafter was named Fuji. And that was actually Mount Fuji, the tallest mountain in Japan. So run in through a lot of Japanese mythology is the idea that the moon, it was natural in the story, the moon was inhabited by celestial beings, and one of them happened to come to Earth. Another way of looking at that is celestial beings coming down to Earth is another way of saying humans travel out to the sky. In the Arabian Nights, or really the 1001 Nights, which is one of the most famous products of Arabian culture and literature, there are many different stories. The story of Sinbad the Sailor is embedded within this and a lot of others, Ali Baba. But in one particular one that's always overlooked is the adventures of a particular hero by the name of Bulukiya. Bulukiya sets himself on the quest to find the herb of immortality, and he has many adventures going through the oceans and lands and everywhere looking for the herb of immortality, and eventually leaves the earth and travels to other worlds, bigger places than our own, in search forever for this herb of immortality. Both of these stories are considered by some people to be sort of the original roots of what we now call the literature of science fiction. They involve either visitors from other worlds coming to Earth, or humans traveling out and visiting other worlds and other places beyond our own. But they're literary imaginings. They're not based on anything more than a mixing of tales, a good story to beguile the night. But the idea of thinking about other worlds, when we come back to the Western tradition of science that we're considering, is the idea of other worlds was pretty much shut down by the Aristotelian and Platonic view of the world as there being no other worlds beyond the Earth. But in the revival of the idea that other worlds were possible came about with the Copernican Revolution. We'll talk more about the Copernican Revolution in detail tomorrow. This was the idea that the Earth was not at the center of the solar system. It was the sun instead. And the Earth was but one of six planets, at least, that were visible to the people at the time that circled the sun. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. What Copernicus did was he basically ended the Aristotelian grip on the idea that the Earth was somehow different than the heavens. Copernicus really said that, no, the Earth and the other planets are similar to each other. They both behave and behave by certain similar rules. He didn't know what those rules were, but the enunciation of that idea was to lead to the scientific revolution, which ultimately led to the elucidation of those rules through the work of people like Kepler, Galileo, and Newton in subsequent generations. But for today, what we're really concerned with is the fact that by moving the Earth from the center of the solar system, from the center of the universe in the Aristotelian view, he made the idea of other worlds possible. But he still had the stars affixed to a celestial sphere. We don't know if that was simply a computational artifice or what he believed, because he doesn't give any details in his great book, De Revolutionibus. But one man did, in fact, examine this, a man by the name of Sir Thomas Digges. He was an astronomer, a British astronomer and mathematician who was working in the generation following Copernicus. It was Digges who popularized the Copernican idea in Britain of the time. Digges realized that what Copernican view of the world meant was that the finitude of the Aristotelian world was no longer necessary. You didn't need some crystalline celestial sphere with the stars attached to it. And in a way, you could think what Thomas Digges really did was he shattered the celestial sphere and spread the stars throughout an infinite universe. If you have an infinite universe, you could have an infinite principle, an infinite number of stars, and around those infinite number of stars, you could have planets, worlds like our own. Why is the sun? The Copernican principle, one of the principles stated by Copernicus was that the Earth is not a special place like Aristotle wanted it to be. We are not the center of the universe. And therefore, if the Earth and maybe the sun is not a special place, Digges took it one step further, there's nothing special about our planetary system. There may be other planetary systems like ours. This was pure speculation. This was basically looking at the consequences of opening up the heavens to an infinite size. You now admit to the possibility of other star systems around other worlds. It was a very powerful idea that began to work its way out. But it also opened up a little Pandora's box. And the Pandora's box is the philosophical box of infinity. When you start to contemplate infinity, things get a little bit scary. And one of those people who paid an unfortunately very high price for the contemplation of infinity was Giordano Bruno. Giordano Bruno was a member of minor orders in the Roman Catholic Church. He was a philosopher. He primarily worked in the area of Neoplatonist philosophy, but he was an extremely brilliant man. His ideas went all over the place, which means he knew a little bit about just about everything and a lot about nothing as a consequence. So his ideas are very chaotic. He's very hard to read in many ways. He was motivated by a tremendous mix of philosophical ideas, and he was also came into contact. He basically ticked off the church almost right away. Now, the charge of heretic was often used to get rid of one's enemies as much as often as not, or people who disagree with you theologically. But let's be frank about Giordano Bruno. From the point of view of the Catholic Church, and by all definitions, he really was a heretic. He really was undertaking a full frontal assault against the major theological teachings of the Roman Catholic Church. And he came into direct conflict with them at a time when that was an extremely dangerous and life-threatening thing to do. He ended up having to flee the Catholic lands and traveled throughout the Protestant world. He went to England for a short time and taught at Oxford, which is where he probably came into contact with Thomas Digges, or at least the writings of Thomas Digges. And he immediately grasped the notion of this idea of the Copernican principle opening up to an infinite number of worlds. And he wrote a very short and frankly somewhat hard to read treatise called On the Infinite Universe and Worlds in the year 1584, in which he went so far as to propose that every single star was exactly like the sun. Each had its system of planets, and on one of those planets must be someplace like the Earth with inhabitants. He even went further and said, of course, well, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, one of the ways in which it gets its theological authority is by saying that they are the representatives of Christ upon earth in the person of the Pope, and therefore are the arbiters and distributors of the grace of the Church. But if there's an infinite number of worlds, how can the Church possibly claim power over those other infinite worlds? And obviously what he was doing was using this as a vehicle to attack the Church's authority on that matter. That's attacking the fundamentals of Christianity. And so, not surprisingly, not only did he make himself somewhat obnoxious to the Roman Catholic Church, the Protestants started not liking him very much. He was a difficult fellow, and he ended up on the road most of his life. Eventually, he ended up getting tricked back into Rome, was put on trial by the Inquisition, and was burned at the stake in the Campo del Fiore of Rome in 1600. He unfortunately puts a very violent end to a series of ideas about other worlds, it kind of gave a bad stink to them for a while. But once the idea is loose, it's really hard to make it go away. A little quote here from him, that the space we declare to be infinite, since neither reason, convenience, possibility, sense perception, nor nature assigned to it a limit. In it are an infinity of worlds that's the same kind as our own. So Bruno really opened up beyond what Copernicus and Diggs did, and really opened up the idea that those other worlds could be like the Earth, and if they were like the Earth, they could be inhabited by people, perhaps people we could talk to. He never explicitly delved into this. This was obviously these airy philosophical flights that he was really fond of, but it sets the intellectual stage. The idea is current. People are thinking about it. So what did people do with that idea? Well, one of the places where the idea appears is not in science, because it's kind of something that's hard to study and people were really concerned with questions they could answer. But it really began to pop up in philosophy and actually propped up in literature as a literary device. And I bring two examples. They both turn out to be from French literature. The first of these comes from Cyrano de Bergerac. You may know him as the principal character of Edmond Rostand's famous play, Cyrano. But in fact, he was a real individual. He was a playwright, a raconteur, a duelist, and a soldier in the French army. He lived in the early 17th century. His posthumously published States and Empires of the Moon is a marvelous, picaresque tale of Cyrano traveling to the moon in a rocket made out of fireworks and going up and meeting the inhabitants of the moon who had four legs and melodious musical voices and all of these various things. Cyrano was not actually making a proper study of what would be the environment like on the moon, how would you get there, what kind of life should arise in that environment. He was using this as a vehicle to poke fun at the French society of the 17th century. These struggles, the pettiness, all the bits and pieces of the society on the moon, he was using as a vehicle for poking fun at French society of this particular period. In a following generation, probably one of the greatest philosophers and playwrights and authors of the French world, of course, Voltaire, who we now know for such plays as Candide, for example, wrote a very short story called The Micromegas in 1752. Here, instead of being like de Bergerac, is a travel of a human being up to a foreign world, meeting the inhabitants of that world. In Voltaire, we're going to turn it around. These are the inhabitants of another world coming down and visiting the Earth. In this case, he imagines an alien by the name of Micromegas, who is a 20-mile-tall visitor from a planet circling the star Sirius. Now, Micromegas stops on his way at Saturn, because of course you're going to stop at the big planets first. He meets a guy in Saturn, they become buddies, there's a whole bit of stuff in there, which only makes sense if you know something a little bit about, you know, French court life of the 18th century before the Revolution. And then they travel, he's also an immense creature, they both travel to the Earth, where they marvel at the smallness of man and the pettiness of his various endeavors. Again, this is Voltaire, who was constantly putting a goad into the society of pre-revolutionary France. This was simply a literary mechanism for doing it. But it was natural for them, at least in their way of doing it, is that they imagined that people could live in other worlds, but they used them as vehicles to comment upon life upon Earth. So it's, again, not a scientific approach to the idea, but seeing the idea turn into a literary device and using it to comment not so much about life on other worlds as life on this world. But the real place where the contemplation of aliens and the contemplation of extraterrestrial life comes into its fore is in the late 19th, of course, and into the 20th and 21st centuries through the literary genre of science fiction. The literary genre of science fiction as we recognize it today really is has a number of antecedents, but really the two greatest practitioners from the late 19th century were the Frenchman Jules Verne and, of course, the Englishman H.G. Wells. And I'm going to pick just one of them as an example because this particular idea, this particular book by H.G. Wells, has turned out to be remarkably persistent as a theme that has run through many different ways of looking at the world. H.G. Wells wrote The War of the Worlds as a short novel in the year 1898. He imagined it as Martians inhabited Mars. Mars was known at that time from the best astronomical work to be a very dry, dead planet. It did seem to have weather, but it seemed to be a dry, dying place. And so what he imagined was that the Martians were an advanced race, but their planet was dying slowly. They turned envious eyes upon the warm, wet Earth, and so they decided to invade it. And invaded it with overwhelming technological force, carrying all the greatest armies of the late 19th century Earth before it, until ultimately they were stopped not by our military force, but because they caught a cold. And having no natural resistance to the cold, they simply all died of terminal congestion, is the best way to put it. Now, was this really a meditation on life on the Mars and technology? Not really. What Wells was doing, really, was he was making a commentary about the late British Empire. The British Empire was the greatest military maritime force in the world during the 19th century. But by the end of the 19th century, the British Empire was in decline. It had major competition beginning to form on the continent with the rise of the major industrial civilizations, primarily Germany. And there were tremendous anxieties in this period of the 1890s through the end of the Victorian era about the rise of the possibility of the end of British imperialism in a violent way. These anxieties were to burst forth only a little over a decade later in the fields of France in World War I, when the actual war did come at the time. But those anxieties about the end of imperialism, instead of putting the invaders to be a European power, he imagined what would happen. You know, the British Empire, wherever they went, had overwhelming technological advantages. They had a navy that could go anywhere. They had modern weaponry. They had modern organization. They absolutely dominated everybody they encountered who were of less highly organized civilizations. They quickly conquered many peace places in Asia. Many of our problems in Asia, in fact, stem from the history of that. But what would happen if this high British society, which was sitting on top of the heap, was suddenly encountering a technologically advanced civilization whose weapons were not effective? And that was really the idea that Wells was putting forward. He was not talking about Martians, but he was looking at how human beings, when they've reached the peak of the pinnacle of technological advancement, encounter someone who's even more technologically advanced and come into conflict with them. It was almost about the morality of British imperialism and its decline. So there's a lot of themes in here, but it doesn't tell us much about it. But War of the Worlds is an amazing story. And it's repeated in a number of places. In 1938, Orson Welles and the Mercury Radio Theater on the Air made a radio play of War of the Worlds. A group of actors got together and basically told the story in a sound studio. They first of all moved the dramatic focus to New Jersey. They seemed to have this deal for wanting to beat up New Jersey at this time, but that's because they were from New York. The first half of the radio program was cast as a fake news broadcast about the arrival of mysterious meteors in New Jersey, suddenly machines coming up, the military being called out. It's very direct. It's really worth going out and finding a recording of it. It's really remarkably well done. But people heard this. It sounded so much like a real news broadcast from New York, a whole bunch of people in the Eastern Seaboard just flipped out. And part of the reason that they flipped out is, look at that year, 1938. This was less than 1 year before the German invasion of Poland that started World War I, a global conflict that was to kill between 70 and 100 million people, most of them non-combatants, and most of them under conditions of unspeakable horror. There was tremendous war fear everywhere in the world at this point. And what this did was it accidentally played directly into those anxieties, and Wells himself was right up front. He was using anxiety about military invasion, but he used War of the Worlds, the story of H.G. Wells, as a vehicle for exploring that kind of what happens if America, which thinks it's actually technologically pretty good, runs into someone who's technologically vastly more advanced. And so when you square that against the very real tensions in pre-World War II Europe, it's not surprising, actually, Wells had to go into hiding after that. There were people actually out for his head. Now, this theme, again, reappears after that war. The very first movie depiction of War of the Worlds was George Pal's 1953 version from Paramount Pictures. It's notable because it was the very first science fiction film to win an Academy Award for special effects. Now, we don't think those special effects are so great by modern standards, but in fact, they were really eye-opening for 1953. George Pal and his writers moved the dramatic focus to the city of Los Angeles in the 1950s, and as part of the movie, incorporated stock footage of World War II combat and also World War II destruction of cities around the world. It was actually, it's kind of cheesy to watch now, again, by our 21st sensibilities, which are highly conditioned by tremendously good special effects. But nonetheless, what really influenced this was, again, anxiety about destruction on a mass scale. In this case now, it's post-World War II anxiety about atomic warfare. and very real. A lot of the footage that was used, a lot of the ideas that were being pushed forward in this movie, and they're kind of on the surface a bit, really was playing to that post-war anxiety. It's what made the story resonate so deeply with people and why it was so popular. And people have tried to actually resurrect it again. In 2005, Steven Spielberg resurrected War of the Worlds. He moved this dramatic focus back to New Jersey. Back to Jersey again, got to take care of them. But in this case, in 2005, now Steven Spielberg was channeling the anxiety as a post-9/11 world, the idea of terrorism. He set the dramatic focus by showing the point of view not as a global view where you could see what was going on from the point of view of the people who were being attacked who didn't know what was going on. It's kind of an interesting way of doing it, and there's also some story about Tom Cruise reconnecting with his kids or something like that. It's kind of disposable. But it shows the resilience of this idea of alien invasion, how people have been able to take this idea, which is more than 100 years old, which originally was a commentary on British imperialism, and turn it into comments about, you know, pre-war anxiety, post-war anxieties about atomic warfare, Tom Cruise's anxiety about connecting with his kid, whatever you want. But they're very strong and powerful ideas. And there's other variations on this theme. Independence Day, you can like or hate this particular little blast fest, but it was also about alien invasion, or Mars Attacks, which is a somewhat funnier version of War of the Worlds. They're all basically variations upon that same theme. I mean, Independence Day is transparently, for better or worse, is War of the Worlds. It's just, instead of being a cold virus, it's a computer virus, and it's awfully cheesy, but it's exactly, they stole the theme. Better CGI. But that's just one way in which we've thought about other people, about visitors from other worlds. The other major theme that appears is a depiction of aliens from other worlds as being highly evolved, technologically advanced super beings. There's a lot of different variations on this, but probably one of the finest of these is the 1951 film The Day the Earth Stood Still. Klaatu here is a visitor from a galactic civilization. He's got his buddy, the robot Gort. They come with overwhelming technology to come warn a post-World War II atomic-powered Earth that they represent a danger to the galactic civilization. They got to clean up their act or the galactic civilization is going to quarantine or annihilate them as a consequence. Now, there's lots and lots of symbolism in this movie. When Klaatu decides to hide among the, after being fired upon and going to the hospital, he decides to hide among the U.S. populace, dressing up as a Mr. Carpenter, and ending up getting killed and then coming back to life. I mean, if you're going to use symbolism, don't make it so obvious that the four-year-old in the front row is tugging on her mother's sleeve and saying, "Look, Mommy, Christ figure." try to be a little more subtle about it. But it basically was a fable about atomic war and the dangers of atomic war. But again, not telling us much about aliens, but kind of an embodiment of our own anxieties. There was a recent remake of this with Keanu Reeves, and that's the most I want to say about it. They turned it into some kind of environmental fable. I actually tried to watch it twice to see if I could figure out what the hell they did to it, and I got out my DVD of the original, and it was much better. The other parallel theme of alien existence is to imagine that they're so far advanced beyond us that they don't even have to appear physically within the story. The idea of super advanced aliens that have actually not just simply visited us but have been the major agents of human development. And of course the classic story of this is 2001 A Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick's marvelous 1968 film, which still plays pretty well. It was notable for another number of reasons, not the least of which it was the first film that really made very realistic depictions of human spaceflight. It set the stage for how we depict spaceflight in cinema, and if you watch any movie that comes after it, the great silence, emptiness, and loneliness of space. That's a theme, an interesting theme that might come into play later in this course when we start considering how do you travel the vast distances between the stars. We begin to see space as not just simply a place to be traversed, but it is in fact a vast, deep, and empty loneliness. But coming out of this thinking has then got people to begin to imagine, well, what do these alien beings look like? Sometimes they come in the guise of human beings. That's largely because of, the power of the Screen Actors Guild. But also, it's interesting how deeply embedded these ideas of alien life have come into our own popular culture. And I thought of various ways to represent this, and of course the most obvious one is the gray alien. This is an immediately recognizable cultural icon. It's so deeply embedded in our popular imagination that if anyone in deep hypnosis says they saw an alien that looks like that, you know they're basically looking at the same pictures of aliens all the rest of us have been looking at since we were kids. The basic description is the alien's sort of long and thin, has a really big head, usually an inverted teardrop. The big head means, ooh, bigger, more evolved brain. Usually has these large, lidless, oval-shaped eyes, gray, hairless skin. They're so advanced they don't need fur anymore. They're obviously evolved to some state. Sometimes the bodies are long and thin with long, spindly arms. Perhaps they're adapted to a planet with low gravity. Perhaps they travel in space, and this is what you get. This is so iconic. If at the beginning of this class I'd said, okay, everybody, take out a piece of paper and sketch an alien, every single one of you would have probably drawn that. Maybe a couple of you would add a couple of antennae. But that would be the basic theme. This is so deeply embedded. It has, you know, it's been used everywhere. Close Encounters of the Third Kind is of course, an obvious one. Alienware computers. My sister made me a wall quilt a number of years ago with beautiful astronomical themes, and she put her signature block is in fact a smiling green alien. And every single episode of South Park has an alien in it. You don't believe me? Watch carefully. I admit I perhaps admitted more about myself than I do because I've actually been watching for the aliens in South Park, but they're there. So what does this tell us? What do our imaginings tell us? Well, it's been kind of fun to put this together and talk about it and look at these themes. Except for the idea of opening up an infinite number of worlds and making the idea that those other planets are places of physical study, our actual imaginings about the nature of life on other worlds to this point is really telling us a great deal about ourselves, but not telling us anything about life on other worlds. So that means in this course we're really not going to be able to use a lot of the literature of science fiction and other aspects do not inform our inquiry at all. We're going to have to look elsewhere for that inquiry. So what do they tell us about ourselves? Well, we've used them to embody our hopes. We've encountered ET as a friendly alien. Perhaps we've given to these alien creatures some really hideous nightmares. Of course, the ultimate alien here. But more also, I think one of the things I also like about this is not only is it hopes and fears, but it's also our occasional wacky sense of humor. Any questions? Okay, well, thank you all very much, and we will see you all tomorrow.